The Australian Medical Students Association acknowledges the traditional owners of the land. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend those respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners tuning in.
Hello, and welcome to AMSA's podcast, Ampule, where we talk about the things you don't learn in med school. Today, I had the pleasure of chatting to Liam Virtue, one of our very own. In this episode, Liam is kind enough to share his story with bone marrow donation and leukemia. Liam is currently running a fundraiser for the Leukemia Foundation, which you can donate to with a link in the description of this podcast. And he speaks to me about some of the great stuff they did for him and his family. We have a pretty lengthy chat about the state of Liam's head, having grown out his hair for the fundraiser, and finish up by debunking some of the myths associated with bone marrow donation. Hope you enjoy. Not everyone is eligible to be a client of BOQ Specialist, but you are. As a medical student, you can join the numerous doctors who have chosen to trust BOQ Specialist with their finances throughout their careers. It doesn't matter if you're at the beginning of your degree or about to graduate. Their suite of products have been designed to suit your needs at every stage of your journey. BOQ Specialist has been working with medical professionals for 30 years and throughout this time have come to understand your career and financial needs from studying through to exiting the profession. Other banks don't understand your career like BOQ Specialist does, particularly that you need the most support while you're studying. So whether you need help with course fees, overseas electives, or even a new laptop, BOQ Specialist are here to help you every step of the way. To speak to your local financial specialist, call 1300 131 141, or for more information, visit boqspecialist.com.au/students. Thanks for joining me today, Liam. Very much appreciated. I thought we'd jump straight into it with a few rapid-fire questions. Since this episode is largely donation-based, I thought we'd kick it off with the simple, what is your blood type?
Very boring, O positive.
So am I, actually. Oh,
match made in heaven.
So close to the fame don't egg, but no. So secondly, how many donations have you clocked in?
I've done 9 blood donations so far, and I've got number 10 booked in next Tuesday.
Yeah, that's a solid effort. Have you won any prizes along the way?
I think I've won a coffee voucher this year with the Vampire Cup, coffee voucher last year, and a textbook this year, yeah.
All right, so next question is, do you have a post-donation ritual? Is there anything in particular you're fiending after a bit of blood loss?
Anything and everything is probably my approach. You know, you got to get the iced chocolate or the iced coffee. And then definitely some cheese and crackers. And unfortunately, with COVID, they haven't had the hot stuff. There's been no pies in the oven, which has been pretty devastating.
Terribly tragic news. It's part of my post-donation ritual as well. I'm a big fan of the meat pies, but I have a bit of a trade secret. I put it in for a minute and a half instead of 2 minutes, which leaves it a bit frozen and crunchy in the middle. It gets you a bit of extra texture.
A bit of crunch.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, so the next question is, just because I'm a big fan of this meme format, if you could be a blood cell, which blood cell would you be?
Yeah, all right. I reckon I would be the good old reliable red blood cell because of my tendency to be pretty plethoric in the face.
I think I will be needing to see a picture of that later on. Okay, so the final question is, which donatable organ would you be and why?
Yeah, I would say that's probably a pretty easy question, and I'm going to go liver. Yeah, I'll leave that one up to the audience's interpretation.
Just to add a bit of context onto that, for those that don't know you, what is your current involvement with AMSA?
Yeah, so I'm this year's events officer on the National Executive, and I was social officer for Hobart Convention last year. There might be a connection there.
Yeah, that checks out. we'll let the audience decipher that correlation there. Free coffee vouchers for anybody that figures that out. Treasury may be in a bit of problems after that, though, but that's okay. Anything for the podcast. Okay, so I reckon we crack on to the meat of the episode now. So you and I spoke a bit last night about your personal story with donations. So would you be able to share that with our listeners?
Yeah. So this year I made the decision to take a gap year from medicine, and I've enjoyed a little bit of a year off. But along with it, I'm doing the world's greatest shave to raise money for the Leukemia Foundation. So I shaved my head on the 1st of Jan, and my face, and I'm growing my hair and beard for 366 days in total. And I guess the reason for that is that this year is actually 15 years since my mum had acute myeloid leukemia. And so before, I guess, leaving any unanswered questions, she's going incredibly well now, wonderfully. But yeah, 15 years ago, she had leukemia.
Yeah, wow, that's really heavy. Great to hear your mum is doing good now, though. So you also shared with me last night a bit of a lighter story about the time surrounding your mum and dad finding out about your mum's possible diagnosis.
Yeah. It's definitely a story I've told a few times. So I've done the fundraiser a couple of times over the years. But mum and dad's birthdays are both late May, early June. And so they decided for their birthdays they were going to have a bit of time away from like 7-year-old Liam, 8-year-old Liam's older brother, and 3-year-old younger brother. So, you know, a bit of a weekend away from the crazy kids. And so we were staying with our grandmother while they, you know, went out to dinner, had a weekend without us. And I think on the Friday evening, mum went to the GP with a couple of large bruises on her leg, thinking it'll be nothing. Had a few blood tests, didn't think anything of it, went home. And then got a call at dinner that night from her GP basically saying, bad luck, you've got leukemia, you need to go to the hospital first thing tomorrow morning. Not exactly a great birthday present, but as kids, we were totally out of the loop because we were with our grandma, we were having a great time, probably eating crumb chicken and watching Deal or No Deal. And actually the next morning when mum was in hospital, we got told that they were having such a great weekend without us that they wanted another day. And so we were happy, you know, we got to go to the park with our cousins. We got to catch up with our aunt and uncle and having a great time, stayed another night with Ma and Da. And then the next morning, Dad rocked up and kind of broke the news to us.
How did that go for you? Do you remember what your like initial reactions were to that?
I don't actually remember exactly when we found out. I know that when Dad picked us up on the Sunday, we basically went straight to the hospital. I don't think there would have been any easy way to tell us, but he must have found some way. But I do remember being at the hospital, seeing Mum there, and then getting some kind of resources made for kids about like Mummy has leukemia, you know, picture book kind of thing, explaining it for, I guess, kid-friendly terms.
Oh, that's insane. I guess maybe there was some grace in you and your siblings being so young. How do you think it would have been on your end if you were a bit older?
I think at the age we were at the time, we were kind of young enough, old enough to know that something was seriously, you know, it was wrong. It was not a great time. But I think we were still young enough that we could be happily left a little bit in the dark about it. And I think we were able to be sheltered from exactly how serious it was, and still kind of live our happy, happy childhood lives. I think if we were much older, it would have been far more difficult for mum and dad to protect us from the seriousness of the situation. I mean, it wasn't a great time as it was for us, but I think it probably would have been worse the older we were.
Yeah, a little bit of a saving grace there, I suppose. You did mention in one of your Facebook posts about benefiting from unlimited talk shop money.
Yes. So because mum was in hospital nearly, you know, full time on and off for several months, and dad was fairly busy, you know, running the household while still working and still finding time to go into the hospital. So packed lunches got put on hold for basically 6 months. And, as you know, a grade 3 Liam, I got to write my own tuck shop order with free rein every day, which was definitely, you know, an absolute silver lining of the experience.
Yeah. Oh, I do miss tuck shop. Think about it every now and then. So what was the timeline from your mum getting diagnosed to eventually getting better?
So she was diagnosed, I think, very end of May, early June. I can't remember the exact date. And then the next, several months were cycles of chemo, a little bit of time at home, cycles of chemo, kind of rinse and repeat, all the way up until December, when the kind of definitive treatment was having a stem cell transplant. And then even after that, there was a long recovery. And so it was probably, just the really acute in and out of hospital side of things, probably went for about 9 months. And then obviously like a longer, much longer recovery for years and years down the track.
Oh, that just sounds so ruthless. I can't even imagine the perseverance of both your mum, your family, everybody involved. With this definitive treatment you mentioned, how does that all work? So stem cell treatments and blood cancers, how does that work?
So for all blood cancers, and I guess starting with blood, all of your blood cells originate from the one type of stem cell in your bone marrow that can go down in all the different pathways to produce your red blood cells, your white blood cells, your platelets. And so as you might know, with chemotherapy basically knocks all your cells off. So it knocks off your really good cells, the still, normal functional ones. And it also knocks off the cancerous cells, which is great, except it's, not exactly a pleasant experience. And so the more chemo you give someone, the more you knock off, their good cells, and the more you actually, harm the person. And so one potential solution to that is give someone so much chemotherapy that you completely nuke their bone marrow and there's, nothing left, which normally would mean that someone would kind of inevitably die. But instead, you come along at the last minute and inject them with some stem cells that will then kind of go to their bone marrow and rescue them from kind of certain demise. That's, how the stem cell transplants work. It lets you have a much bigger dose of chemo than you'd normally be able to, and hopefully that cures.
I do remember reading somewhere, probably in a lecture actually, that effective chemo is essentially running somebody down to the point where they're just about dead in the hope that the cancer falls first. And to me, that sort of underlies the importance of bone marrow donations, which we will jump on very soon. But before we get to that, I'm wondering about your story of making your way into med school and how much your mom's story impacted that.
Actually, very, very absent in the getting into medicine. I don't know how, but the thought of mum's journey and my journey through that didn't actually cross my mind till I'd started med, which meant that the essay in first year of why did you want to do medicine was when I kind of realized, oh, I did have a significant experience with the healthcare system in my childhood, but it honestly wasn't the reason I did med. It did make med, I think, far more interesting once I was in. And I think in first year, when we first learnt about, blood cells and blood counts, I managed to get mum to dig up some of her old doctor's letters and some of her old blood tests. And on some of her old blood tests, where there should normally be a number far greater than zero, and zero is very, very, very not normal, it actually just said zero. And I remember as a first year being pretty proud of myself because I could tell that the normal range did not include zero and the number was zero. So something wasn't right. And then I think I've used some of her old documents and tests. Yeah, that was when I knew that I was meant to be in medicine, huge IQ moment. But I've then kind of used those documents as a bit of a metric as I've gone through. When we actually learned a little bit more about hematology in second year, the letters to a GP started making a little bit more sense. And then when I first started clinical placements, the kind of clinical context of it made a bit more sense. And I did a 6-week elective in hematology at the end of last year. And then actually I recognised the names of the chemo drugs, and that felt pretty good.
Yeah, so it's a pretty unique story you have there where, you know, you were in year three when your mum was diagnosed and then you later on ended up in medical school. So sort of between those two points, how did the, on reflection, gravity or your perception of the gravity of the situation change?
I think we knew it was serious. I think we were told it was serious. I don't think we were that sheltered from it. And I think it was also pretty apparently clear that it was serious. I think when you see someone who's, at like rock bottom of chemotherapy, right at the worst of it, they're very visibly unwell. You know, the bald, no hair, gaunt, just sick looking. And I think there was no hiding that from us. I'm not sure how we kind of coped with that as kids. I think there was a bit of distracting us from it. I think we went to Dreamworld a couple of times more than we normally would through that period. All of Mum's friends and our family were really supportive, and you know, there was always stuff for us to do, which I think probably meant that there was a little bit less time to really reflect on it too much.
How did things change for you once you started like learning about everything cancer in med school?
I think one big one was Dad's work. So he was working full time at the time and kept it up a little bit, but then his work was supportive enough to basically say, you need to take an indefinite amount of time off to, you know, support your wife and your family through this, and basically just let him be as flexible as he needed, and with a promise of a job at the other side. And I think that was great for him because it meant that he could spend as much time as he wanted in the hospital by Mum's side and could, you know, be there for us as the kids as well to still be able to give us a little bit of time. So I think his work was an amazing support. And I don't think I really, as kids, that was completely off our radar. It was only years later that I kind of heard about that and realized just how significant that really is.
Yeah. And going into medical school, did you have sort of a new view on things once you started learning about, I guess, everything cancer related in medical school?
Yeah, I think it kind of made it all make sense. I think learning about, you know, leukemia, learning about cancer, chemotherapy, and all of that, I think connected a couple of the dots of the journey. I remember, you know, we had to wash our hands really thoroughly. We had to put on aprons when we went to see Mum. We had to be careful we weren't coughing or sneezing and things like that. I mean, try telling that to a 7-year-old, basically like walking vectors. But I don't think we took it particularly seriously back then as kids. We did it because we were told to, but it just didn't quite click that it was actually incredibly important. And I remember when, you know, learning about obviously how immunocompromised someone is in the middle of chemo as a medical student and kind of thinking, goddamn, 7-year-old Liam was really not taking that seriously enough. I just remembered probably the worst example of that. For 6 months, we were actually living in Leukemia Foundation accommodation in Brisbane City through the transplant and the recovery from it. And me and my brothers were playing on the playground, and at some point someone decided that a fun game would involve trying to spit on each other. Don't ask me why, but like literally sums up poor infection control in kids and our lack of awareness of the whole situation. All I remember is when Dad got wind. I think we did realize how serious it was when Dad got wind of it and kind of, probably ripped into us a little bit, rightfully so.
Well, the silver lining there, I suppose, is that you're no longer in year three. Otherwise, I fear Australia would stand no chance against COVID with Liam the super spreader running around.
Yeah, I'd like to think I'd do a bit better these days.
Yeah, So another story of yours that I'd love to share with the audience is the crazy, crazy coincidence that was the 14th anniversary of your mum's diagnosis.
Yeah, so it was the 14th anniversary of her bone marrow transplant, actually.
Oh, it was as well.
Which was even better. Last December. Yeah. Yeah, even better. So last December, on the 14th anniversary of Mum's bone marrow transplant, I got a phone call at 8 in the morning that woke me up from the bone marrow registry saying that I was a potential match to be a bone marrow donor for someone else. And if that wasn't coincidence enough on its own, that day I was actually on placement as part of my elective in the stem cell lab in Brisbane. So yeah, anniversary of Mum's transplant, placed in the transplant lab, and I got a call from the registry saying I was a potential match.
Yeah, that's unreal. Doesn't matter what you believe in, that's got to be a sign from somewhere. So tell me a bit about your story yourself with bone marrow donation.
Yeah, so I got the call waking me up in the morning saying it was a potential match. And then that afternoon I had to go along to the Red Cross Blood Centre where they had to take off some blood to do a bunch of extra tests to see if I was actually a perfect match or not. And so I went off, had a blood tests, and then they tell you, well, now you just wait. It could be up to 3 months before you hear any more. And so in the end, actually, I wasn't the best match for that patient. And so I'm back on the registry, hopefully, you know, waiting to help someone out one day. But I think that patient probably found someone better.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be able to go full circle at some point.
Yeah, it came so close, so close.
So this episode is inevitably a bit of propaganda. Beneficial propaganda, but propaganda nonetheless. And so I thought it'd be useful to talk a bit about bone marrow transplants and myth-busting some of the big myths. One that I brought onto the table in our previous conversation was that I thought they had to yeet a massive needle into you to get some out of you. So could you give me a cheeky little overview of all things bone marrow donations and speak to a couple of the myths for me?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with the misconception about you always yeeting a big needle into you. And so, yeah, what does it mean to actually donate bone marrow to someone? I guess that the first point is that calling it a bone marrow donation is probably actually a bit of a reason behind the misconception, because you're not giving them bone marrow, you're giving them the stem cells that will save their lives. And so traditionally, yeah, the way that was done was yeeting a big needle into the back of your hip to actually just take bone marrow out of your pelvis, which is done under an anaesthetic. So it's obviously, you know, you're not feeling it, but, you know, a bit of a bruise afterwards and probably not the most comfortable thing. But actually, these days, 90% of donations are actually done completely differently from that. And it's pretty much no different to donating platelets or plasma. So no big needle into your bone to take out bone marrow, but just centrifuging stem cells out of your blood. So hopefully slightly more appealing for people. But a lot of people don't actually realize that. Yeah, people don't realize that's the case, and that's, you know, 9 out of 10 times that's how it's done these days. And when it is a big needle into your bone, that's mainly when the patient is a really little kid. And so hopefully the thought of saving a cute little kid's life is probably enough to make it worthwhile.
Okay, now that we've gotten rid of the misconception of needing to yeet a massive needle into you to get some bone marrow out of you, explain to me how you would chat to somebody who's never donated before and convince them to donate. What's your normal spiel? You know, someone's like, why should I give my blood away? What are you going to say to them?
Yeah. So I think blood donation is incredibly important, probably just because of the number of different things that it can help with. So the three different types of donation you can do for blood. which is whole blood, platelets, and plasma. And each of those has countless different ways that that can help people. And I guess it's, you're going there, you're giving up your time to do the donation. You're giving up a little bit of your blood, but you've got plenty of that. And in return, not only are you getting, as we discussed before, party pies, cheese and crackers, hot chocolates, iced chocolates, you know, whatever you want, but you're actually saving people's lives. And I assume a large part of the audience of this podcast are medical students. And so clearly you're in the business of saving people's lives, I would hope. So, start now, donate blood, and, you know, save some lives before you're actually qualified to do it in any other way.
Yeah, that's a great point. I do remember getting a text saying where the blood was sent to. And I remember it saying you saved X number of lives. Very nice.
Yeah, and I think it reminds you why you're doing it. It is, as much as you might think it's just for the chalky milk, there's also a probably slightly more important reason behind it.
Exactly right. I did at one point, though, walk through a really busy library and think in my head, why the hell are you sat down? I've just saved 30 lives. Get off.
Don't you know who I am?
On the note of donating, I think the next big question is, I guess, who is eligible to donate?
So to donate bone marrow compared to donate blood, I guess there's a few differences between it. Donating blood, obviously the best place to go is to the Red Cross Lifeblood site to check if you're eligible. But generally, you know, male or female, young or old, your blood is blood and they'll take it and it'll be just as useful. But there are a few exclusions to that that affect quite a lot of people around, recent travel, if you've lived in the UK, if you've had tattoos, and even if you're a man who has had sex with men recently, that can be an exclusion for blood donation. But donating bone marrow is actually quite different in kind of who's best as a donor, and also, you know, reasons that you might not be suited. And so young people are the most important people to be bone marrow donors and be on the registry, because there's evidence that the younger the donor is, actually the more successful the stem cells are going to be and the better the outcomes people will have. And so again, I'm assuming this podcast audience are largely young 20-something medical students. And so you are absolutely the best people to go and sign up to be a bone marrow donor. And also some of those exclusions for blood donations don't actually apply to being on the bone marrow registry. So it doesn't matter if you lived in the UK, it doesn't matter if you've traveled recently, it doesn't matter if you've had tattoos, and it doesn't matter your sexual preferences. You can be on the bone marrow registry.
Yeah, that's great. I guess the with less eligibility criteria for bone marrow donation, it gives the ability to give back to a broader set of people, which is great. So how do you sign up for this lovely registry?
To actually get on the registry is another, how to do that is another misconception. Because up until last year, the only way you could get on the registry was to actually be a blood donor. And when you went and donated blood, they could take off an extra vial and send that to the registry to get your details in. But since 2019, there's actually another way, which is far simpler, because you don't need to be a blood donor. You don't even need to be eligible to donate blood. And you can just swab your cheek, mail that swab in, and then you're on the registry. And so that's their new campaign, Strength to Give. And you can go to strengthtogive.org.au. And if you're aged, I think, 18 to 35, they can send you a cheek swab. And that's it. You're on the registry. And you might be a match to save someone's life.
Yeah, so where was I? Oh, yeah. So I've had Facebook for about 24 hours, but I have had a little scroll. So this is obviously a podcast, so there's no visuals, but would you be able to give me a quick description of the state of your head?
Yeah, it doesn't go too well over podcast form, but I think my current profile picture can be summed up as, I think my dad commented on it. I think it was a good summary. He commented, samurai pirate barista. So my hair's long enough that I can put a little bit of a kind of samurai top knotty looking thing. I can put a hair tie in my beard and have that kind of bundled together. It's long enough for that. And then I think the combination of that is kind of your stereotypical inner city latte drinking hipster. I don't go around day to day with a hair tie in my hair or beard at the moment. But I will do literally anything to encourage donations.
And how long have you got left to go?
So I shaved on the 1st of January this year, and then I'm doing the kind of the shave at on the 1st of January 2021. So yeah, three and a half months to go.
I'm excited to see what he gets to in another 6 months from now.
Guys, it's getting bad enough. It's getting literally impossible to control. I wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and it's not pretty.
Yeah, you're going to have to black out all the mirrors and reflective surfaces around your house.
Yeah, live in denial of just how shocking I do look.
No, it is beautiful. We're redefining what beauty is right here. So what was your setup prior to this? What was the hair and facial hair situation?
Yeah, generally short-ish hair, depending on how long it had been since my last haircut and how motivated I was to get one, but never properly long or anything like that. Definitely never long enough to put in any kind of top knot. And then face, it depended exclusively on how close I was to exams. Always got a little bit of beard going in SWAT vacs and over the summer holidays, but generally pretty clean shaven on placements at least.
Yeah, pretty typical. I'm pretty similar, especially coming near exams. Does not get shaved nearly as much as it should. But unfortunately, I have terrible facial hair genetics, so it gets super, super patchy. And the patchiness gets worse as it gets longer. So if I ended up participating in a similar format, God help us. It'll truly be to the detriment of everybody else.
Yeah, well, feel sorry for the people of Tasmania then, because my beard's not even. It's. I think the patchiness became irrelevant soon after starting. But just the kind of, the bulky bit of the beard under my chin, the left-hand side is probably a good centimeter or so longer than the right. And it's really obvious, but there's literally nothing I can do about it because I'm not touching a hair on my head for 12 months.
Do you do any beard care stuff?
Initially, no. And then I kind of realized I had to do something to try and tame it. I had to invest in a suitable brush to kind of untangle it, and then I grabbed some beard oil and I felt kind of dirty buying that. It was like I felt a little bit too hipster for what I actually am, but it turned out it was a waste of money because the Tassie winter was too cold, but the beard oil went solid and I couldn't pump it out of its little bottle into my hand. Yeah, so I had to buy a beard balm instead, so now I own two beard products, balm and oil.
Very hipster of you. I'm excited to see at the end, after you've shaved your head, what it looks like.
Yeah, it'll be a big change from kind of wild, I don't know, looks like I've been lost to society for a couple of years, to the complete skinhead, clean-shaven look on the 1st of January.
Out of interest, did the Tassie Medrev try to con you into a skit revolving around your facial hair, like one of those TV shows where they crash on a desert island?
Tums doesn't do a med review. No, we don't even have one. So, didn't even have that opportunity. Yeah.
So I've gotten us a bit off track with some beard chat, but can you remind everybody again, what's this all for? Who's the fundraiser for?
Yeah. So the fundraiser is for the Leukemia Foundation of Australia. And so where that money goes, that is something I have firsthand experience on. And I can say firsthand that every cent you donate goes to an incredibly worthwhile cause. I guess examples of how they helped us, everything from the resources for how to tell your kid that mum has cancer, you know, that was Leukemia Foundation brochures and leaflets. Living in accommodation for 6 months in the centre of Brisbane at no expense to us, that was the Leukemia Foundation. Getting Christmas presents from the Leukemia Foundation, that was nice. And just generally supporting our family through the process. I know, I guess other examples, they ran a kind of a class for cancer patients, particularly women who've lost their hair through chemo, helping them feel a little bit back to normal, teaching them how to do makeup and things like that to kind of mitigate how they feel, from the chemo and feel like they're back to what they were. So lots of things, every aspect of how leukemia and blood disorders can impact you, they've got something there to support.
Yeah, firsthand evidence there of how good of a cause it is. So how can people find your fundraiser and contribute?
Yeah, so hopefully we'll have a link to it with this podcast. So have a look for that. If you feel like stalking me on Facebook, you'll probably find it there too. My fundraiser posts are public, and it'll give you a chance to see the pictures we were talking about. So that'd be the main two ways. Anywhere where this podcast is, hopefully there'll be a link, and then stalk me on Facebook.
Yeah, there will be a link in the description of this podcast, and also feel free to stalk Liam on Facebook. Maybe leave some nice comments. One other thing I picked up on in our earlier chat, is there anything special you're doing with your hair after you cut it all off?
So I looked it up. I did the maths. Unfortunately, my hair won't be long enough to donate at the end of the year. But I was actually reading up, and you can donate your hair whatever the length, and it actually goes towards cleaning up oil spills. So they do something with the hair and they process it, and then it apparently hair is great for absorbing oil spills from the ocean and saving sea life.
It's pretty funny to think of your hair once in a top knot will in not too long be going around cleaning up some oil spills.
I mean, hopefully there'll be no oil spills to clean up, but that's a bit unlikely.
Yeah. It is 2020.
Bring on the next disaster.
Yeah, that's it. One a month.
Thanks very much, Liam, for coming and having a chat with me. It was really great to hear your story and sort of hear first-hand experience of everything, blood donation, bone marrow donation, and all the good that your fundraiser is doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for tuning into AMPS's AMPure podcast, where we discuss the things you don't talk about in med school.
The Empire Cup in 2020 supports Bone Marrow Donation Day on the 19th of September and acknowledges the potential of a life-saving treatment, as well as encouraging prospective donors to sign up to the registry through Lifeblood AU. Along with our continued support of blood and organ donation, we encourage medical students, as well as friends and family, to sign up, as the Australian Bone Marrow Donor Registry is always looking for young, committed, ethnically diverse donors. To enrol, simply fill out the form at a blood donor centre. If you'd like to donate to Liam's fundraiser, please just look in the description of this podcast and you'll find a link to take you right there. And go give blood.
Hey everyone, now I know the chair is infallible, but this chair needs a sit down, brackets, for exams, close brackets. AMPU will be returning to a theatre near you in 2 weeks. Enjoy the break.
The views, information, or opinions expressed during the AMSA AMPU series do not necessarily represent those of the Australian Medical Student Association.